Adams had not only failed to express sufficient sympathy for the French, but had sounded a war whoop. How, if he wanted to avoid war, could he press Congress to build up the Navy? Benjamin Bache turned with a fury on the president he had so recently lauded as a prudent, high-minded man of integrity. In almost daily attacks in the Aurora, Adams was belittled as the president by three votes, mocked again as his rotundity, excoriated as a base hypocrite, a tool of the British, a man divested of his senses. He was charged again and again as a creature of Hamilton and the Federalist Warhawks. In fact, most Federalists at this point, including Hamilton, recognized the need for a renewed effort to treat with France. And, as Adams did not know, it was largely because of Hamilton's influence that the cabinet had given their full support to the peace mission. Within days, Adams appointed two special envoys who, with General Pinckney, would comprise a new commission to proceed to Paris. He chose John Marshall of Virginia, whom he did not know, and his own former aide in Paris, Francis Dana. But when Dana declined because of poor health, Adams named Elbridge Gerry. Marshall, a 42-year-old lawyer, was an ardent champion of George Washington, under whom he had served gallantly in the war. A cousin of Jefferson's, but not an admirer of the vice president, he was known to be able, skilled in the law, and, as mattered greatly, he was one of Virginia's few Federalists. Secretary of State Pickering and others in the cabinet strongly approved the choice. Elbridge Gerry, however, was unacceptable to Pickering and the cabinet, who thought him too independent and unreliable. "It is 10-1 against his agreeing with his colleagues," Secretary of War McHenry warned the president. Even Abigail questioned the choice, but Adams insisted. He needed someone on the commission whose friendship and loyalty were beyond doubt. He knew Gerry. "I knew Gerry infinitely better than any of them," he later said. The old bond of 1776 was still a tie that held Adams to Rush and even to Jefferson, for all the strains of politics. From the time of their ride to Philadelphia by horseback in the crisis winter of 1776, Adams had felt Gerry was someone to count on, and he was prepared to do just that in the present crisis. With the exception of his own son, John Quincy, there was perhaps no man in whom Adams placed more trust. Also, importantly, of the three envoys, Gerry was the most sympathetic to France, and, with his open admiration of Jefferson, came the closest to making it a bipartisan commission. Later, when Marshall arrived in Philadelphia, Adams felt still better about the makeup of the commission. He and Marshall liked each other at once, even used virtually the same words to describe one another. Marshall judged Adams a sensible, plain, candid, good-tempered man, while Adams wrote of Marshall, "He is a plain man, very sensible, cautious, and learned in the law of nations." In Paris, the three American envoys would be dealing with the extremely wily and charming new French foreign minister, Charles Maurice de Talleyrand Périgord. A former bishop in the Catholic Church, Talleyrand had only recently returned to France after more than 2 years in exile in Philadelphia, where he had been well treated. Adams had known him, but only slightly, not enough to have a sense of what to expect. The undeclared war at sea continued. That spring, Adams was informed that already the French had taken more than 300 trading vessels. American seamen had been wounded. In March, the French captors of a ship out of Baltimore, the Cincinnatus, had tortured the American captain with thumbscrews in an unsuccessful attempt to make him say he was carrying British cargo. "The task of the president is very arduous, very perplexing, and very hazardous. I do not wonder Washington wished to retire from it, or rejoiced in seeing an old oak in his place," observed Abigail, who in her letters to her sister Mary was to provide an inside look at the Adams presidency like no other, much as she had in portraying their life in France and London years before, writing always to the moment and with untrammeled candor. Adams was in his office in the president's house most of every day, and from such close application looked exhausted. She took charge of the large house, supervised the staff, and sent off orders to Mary for shipments of the president's favorite New England cheese, bacon, white potatoes, and cider. In keeping with old habit, she told Mary, their day began at 5 in the morning. Breakfast was at 8, and they saw each other again at dinner, customarily served at 3. I begin to feel a little more at home and less anxiety about the ceremonious part of my duty, Abigail allowed. I am obliged every day to devote 2 hours for the purpose of seeing company. The day is past, and a fatiguing one it has been. She closed another letter at 8 o'clock in the evening. The ladies of foreign ministers and the ministers, with our own secretaries and ladies, have visited me today, and add to them the whole levy today of Senate and House. Strangers, etc., making near 100, asked permission to visit me, so that from past 12 till near 4 o'clock, I was rising up and sitting down. She was both involved and vitally interested in her husband's world. She read all the newspapers, and in time came to know the names and faces of everyone in Congress, their background, and political views. Little transpired in the Capitol that she did not know about. Yet her interest in matters at home never flagged. She kept contact with nieces and nephews, inquired regularly about the welfare of her pensioners, Parson Wibird, who had grown old and infirm, and her aged former servant Phoebe, to whom she sent money and made sure she had sufficient firewood and whatever other necessities were wanting. The president's worries and burdens were never out of mind. Mrs. Tufts once styled my situation splendid misery, Abigail reminded Mary. Interestingly, it was a phrase Vice President Jefferson also used to describe the presidency. When Adams named John Quincy to be minister to Prussia, more Republican protest erupted. Washington had never appointed relatives to office, it was said, not even distant relatives. The president must resign, charged the Aurora, before it is too late to retrieve our deranged affairs. When Congress chose to leave some matters to the discretion of the president, the Aurora attacked Adams for his excessive vanity. We may truly say we know not what a day will bring forth, Abigail observed in her running account. From every side we are in danger. We are in perils by land, and we are in perils by sea, and in perils by false brethren. Whom she meant by false brethren she did not say. But the vice president all the while did nothing whatever to help his former friend the president. Further, he made no secret of his belief that Adams was leading the nation straight to war. After years of seclusion at Monticello, Jefferson had, with amazing agility, stepped back into the kind of party politics he professed to abhor, and in no time emerged as leader of the opposition. With Madison in retirement, and the vice presidency providing ample free time, Jefferson kept extremely busy as a closet politician, in one man's expression, writing letters and lending support, ideas, information, and money, to the Republican press, including such gladiators of the quill as a dissolute Scottish pamphleteer and scandalmonger named James T. Callender, who wrote for the Aurora and specialized in attacks on John Adams. The Francis Hotel, where Jefferson continued to lodge, became headquarters for the Republican inner circle. Any pretense of harmony between the president and vice president was dispensed with. Like other Republicans, Jefferson failed to understand how Adams could reconcile negotiation for peace with measures of defense, and in private correspondence accused Adams of willfully endangering the peace. When some of this got back to Adams, he angrily declared it bespoke a mind eaten to a honeycomb with ambition, yet weak, confused, uninformed, and ignorant. Yet, given all that Jefferson was doing, and the combustible atmosphere of the moment, Adams's rancorous comments were remarkably few and mild. Many in the Federalist Party suspected Jefferson of outright treachery against his own country. Convinced that the best hope for the world was the defeat of Britain by France, and that such an outcome was imminent, Jefferson privately advised the French chargé d'affaires in Philadelphia, Philippe-Henri-Joseph de Latombe, that the Directory should show the three American envoys all proper courtesy, but then drag out the negotiations at length. Latombe wrote of the meeting with the wise Jefferson in a report to his foreign minister, dated June 7, 1797. America, Jefferson had impressed upon Latombe, was penetrated with gratitude to France, and would never forget that it owes its liberation to France. The new President of the United States was another matter, however. Jefferson was unsparing. Mr. Adams is vain, irritable, stubborn, endowed with excessive self-love, and still suffering pique at the preference accorded Franklin over him in Paris. But Adams's term of office was only 4 years, Jefferson reminded Latombe. Besides, Adams did not have popular support. He only became president by 3 votes, and the system of the United States will change along with him. Possibly these were not Jefferson's exact words. Possibly his assessment of Adams was not as harsh and patently disloyal as Latombe's account would make it appear. But if what Latombe recorded was all that Jefferson had to say for Adams, this would seem to have proved the end of a long friendship. And whatever Jefferson's exact words may have been, clearly the chargé d'affaires was led to conclude that the difficulties of the moment were not a question of American regard for France, but of the difficult, unpopular, aberrant old man who temporarily held office as president. The truth, it happens, was that Adams and Jefferson both wanted peace with France, and each was working to attain that objective, though in their decidedly different ways. Summer marked the departure of the envoys. Gary sailing from Boston, Marshall from Philadelphia, where Congress sweltered and fumed, trying to wind up business before the sick season came on. She could not wait to start for home, Abigail wrote. She longed for a sea breeze and her rosebush. The president really suffers for want of a journey, or rather for want of some relaxation, she told Mary Cranch. Today will be the 5th great dinner I have had, about 36 gentlemen today, as many more next week, and I shall have to get through the whole of Congress with their appendages. Then comes the 4th of July, which is a still more tedious day, as we must then have not only all Congress, but all the gentlemen of the city, the governor and officers and companies. I hope the day will not be hot. The 4th turned out to be a fine, cool day, and her reception a great success. My fatigue arose chiefly from being dressed at an early hour and receiving the very numerous sets of company who were so polite as to pay their compliments to me in succession in my drawing room after visiting the president below and partaking of cake, wine, and punch with him. To my company were added the ladies of foreign ministers and home secretaries with a few others. The parade lasted from 12 until 4 o'clock. To at least one of those present, she and the president seemed the picture of calm good cheer. Henrietta Liston, the British ambassador's wife, described Adams as steady and resolute, while Mrs. Adams has spirit enough to laugh at Bache's abuse of her husband, which poor Mrs. Washington could not do. In days, the city had become a bakehouse again, as Abigail wrote. The hot weather of July has weakened us all. Complaints of the bowels are very frequent and troublesome. Strangely, cats were dying all over the city. The streets were filled with dead cats. No one had an explanation, and no one in Congress wished to delay departure an hour longer than necessary. On July 10th, exhausted, irritable members of both houses started for home, convinced the special session had only aggravated party divisions. Adams had hoped it would help unite the country, and in this, plainly, he had failed. There was some consolation, however. After a good deal of fuss and bickering, Congress had at last approved an act providing a naval armament. It was hardly what Adams had called for, but it was a start, providing funds to equip and man three frigates, the Constitution, the United States, and the Constellation, which had been built during the Washington administration but remained unequipped for service. With a cooling rain falling, the Adamses started for home on July 19th. Why, asked the Aurora, had the President of the United States absconded from the seat of government at a time when the public mind was exceedingly agitated? Section 3. It was a summer without incident. There was no news from France, no worsening or lessening of the crisis. For Adams, the pleasures of August and September at Peacefield had all the desired effect. By the time they were heading back to Philadelphia, he and Abigail were both rested and revived. Abigail wrote of feeling better than she had in years. Also, one news item appears to have added considerably to their outlook. John Quincy and Louisa Catherine Johnson had been married, as the Adamses learned just before leaving home. The small announcement in a Boston paper, like the first word from John Quincy himself, appeared 2 months after the fact. The young couple were married on July 26th in the ancient Anglican church known as All Hallows Barking by the Tower of London. "I have now the happiness of presenting to you another daughter," read John Quincy's letter to his dear and honored parents, each of whom responded with an appropriately warm letter of congratulations. "And may the blessing of God Almighty be bestowed on this marriage and all its connections and effects," wrote Adams in benediction. The departure from Quincy took place in the first week of October, but the Adamses were not to reach the capital for more than a month. Yellow fever again raged in Philadelphia, as they learned en route, and so it was necessary to stop and wait at Eastchester with Nabby. Adams was kept apprised by daily reports. 2/3 of the population of Philadelphia had fled the city. The government had scattered to various outlying towns. He imagined members of Congress stranded along the way all up and down the country, all waiting as he was, in a very disagreeable, awkward, and uncertain situation. Told there had been an attempt to break into the president's house and asked if a guard should be posted, Adams said no, lest a sentinel at the door lead people to think the situation worse than they knew. The wait at Eastchester was not easy, as much as he and Abigail adored Nabby and the four grandchildren. The house was small, and the continued absence of Colonel Smith cast a shadow. Abigail found Eastchester itself unbearably dull. She worried about Nabby living there, and urged her to come with the children to Philadelphia. "I cannot leave her here this winter with not a single creature within 20 miles of her to speak a word to or shorten the long, solitary winter evening," she told Mary. But Nabby refused. "I cannot say as much as is in my mind," wrote Abigail, the subject being a very delicate one. Adams went to New York for a dinner in his honor. Otherwise, to fill the time, there was little but the newspapers and talk of a sensational scandal involving Alexander Hamilton. Possibly for Abigail, who claimed to have seen the very devil in Hamilton's eyes, the story came as no surprise. The Reynolds affair was a complicated tangle of financial dealings, adultery, blackmail, and alleged corruption in the Department of the Treasury, all dating back 5 years. In 1792, while his wife and children were away, Hamilton had become involved in an improper connection with a young woman named Maria Reynolds. Her husband, James Reynolds, a speculator with an unsavory reputation, commenced to blackmail Hamilton, until the point when he, Reynolds, went to prison for an earlier swindle. It was then, while in prison, that Reynolds, in an effort to ease his case, got word to three Republican members of Congress, including Senator James Monroe, that Hamilton was not only an adulterer, but as Secretary of the Treasury, secretly profiteering with government funds. When the three confronted Hamilton with the charges, he denied any corrupt act as a public official, but acknowledged the affair with Mrs. Reynolds and the blackmail plot, with the understanding that they, as gentlemen, would keep silent, which they did to a degree. A few more were let in on the secret, including the Republican clerk of the House, John Beckley, and Thomas Jefferson. But it was not until that summer of 1797 that the story broke in a series of unsigned pamphlets produced by James Callender, the unscrupulous writer for the Aurora, whose source, apparently, was Beckley. Callender dismissed the adulterous affair as a cover story and accused Hamilton of being a partner with Reynolds in corrupt financial dealings. In response, Hamilton published his own pamphlet, Observations on Certain Documents in Which the Charge of Speculation Against Alexander Hamilton is Fully Refuted. He denied any improper speculation with James Reynolds, but confessed to the adulterous affair. My real crime, Hamilton wrote, is an amorous connection with his wife. Hamilton's disgrace was a windfall for the Republicans and all who had long thought him corrupt. Presumably, the scandal would put a finish to his public career. Jefferson appears to have made no comment on the Reynolds affair. Nor did Adams, though it is certain he and Abigail heard plenty. Such was the mood in Philadelphia when, in November, they arrived back at the president's house after an absence of fully 4 months. Alas, alas, how weak is human nature, wrote Abigail to her son Thomas. There was still no report from the three envoys to France. Speaking before Congress on November 23rd, Adams could acknowledge only that the unpleasant state of things continued. The wait would go on, and the lack of information, plus the suspicion that some people knew more than they were saying, only put nerves further on edge. Feelings ran deep, dividing the parties, dividing old friends. Men who have been intimate all their lives, wrote Jefferson, cross the streets to avoid meeting and turn their heads another way, lest they should be obliged to touch their hats. In Europe, French armies had been sweeping across Italy and Austria in a campaign of French aggrandizement led by young General Napoleon Bonaparte, who appeared invincible. Now, with the start of a new year, 1798, Bonaparte had been given command of all forces on land and sea to carry the war across the Channel to Britain. And as John Quincy reported to his father, the expedition was in great forwardness. Bonaparte shortly was to change his mind and lead his forces to Egypt instead, as John Quincy would also report. The French had become formidable as never before. January 1798 in Congress Hall in Philadelphia, by contrast, was marked by a battle royal on the floor of the House. Vicious animosity of a kind previously confined to newspaper attacks broke out in the first physical assault to occur in Congress. In the midst of debate, when Federalist Roger Griswold of Connecticut insulted Republican Matthew Lyon of Vermont, Lyon crossed the chamber and spat in Griswold's face. Soon after, Griswold retaliated with a cane. Lyon grabbed fire tongs from the fireplace, and the two went at each other until, kicking and rolling on the floor, they were pulled apart. To some, the scene provided comic relief. To others, it was sad testimony to how very far the Republican ideal had descended. It was also apt prelude to much that would follow. Step by step, events were moving toward the precipice, as Adams said. The first hint of trouble with the mission to France had been in a letter to Adams from General Pinckney in November, but it was a hint only, nothing to go on. In January, again in a private letter, came word from John Marshall by way of The Hague, warning that the mission might not be received by the French Directory. In February, to make the tension still worse, Adams had to inform Congress that a French privateer had actually attacked a British merchant ship inside Charleston Harbor. "We are yet all in the dark respecting our envoys," Abigail wrote on February 16th. And again, in another week, "Our envoys have been near 6 months in Paris, but to this hour not a line has been received." In the meanwhile, as the president was unaware, his cabinet, Wolcott and McHenry in particular, were receiving continued advice and directions from Alexander Hamilton, who had supposedly retired from public life. Hamilton was still opposed to war with France. "It is an undoubted fact that there is a very general and strong aversion to war in the minds of the people of the country," he wrote to McHenry. "It is an undoubted fact that there is a very general indisposition toward the war in the minds of the people of the United States," McHenry dutifully advised the president 4 days later. But should the present attempt to negotiate fail, then the president must address the Congress in a style cautious, solemn, grave, and void of asperity, declared McHenry, Hamilton also having told him that this was what he was to say. At last, late the evening of March 4th, a year to the day since Adams became president, official dispatches arrived in Philadelphia and were delivered immediately to Timothy Pickering's desk at the Department of State at 5th and Chestnut Streets. 4 of the dispatches were in cipher, and it would be several days before they were decoded. But the message of the 5th dispatch was clear. Seething with indignation, Pickering pulled on a coat and hurried 3 blocks to the president's house. What Adams read was extremely unsettling. The government of France had refused to see the envoys. The mission had failed. Furthermore, the Directory had decreed all French ports closed to neutral shipping and declared that any ship carrying anything produced in England was subject to French capture. Promptly the next morning, Monday, March 5th, Adams sent the uncoded dispatch to Congress. But there was more to the story, as he soon learned with the decoding of the other dispatches. After arriving in Paris in the first week of October, the 3 American envoys were kept waiting for several days and then were granted a meeting with Foreign Minister Talleyrand for all of 15 minutes. More days of silence followed. Then began a series of visits from 3 secret agents representing Talleyrand, Jean-Conrad Ottinger, Pierre Bellamy, and Lucien Hauteval, who were referred to by the Americans in their dispatches as X, Y, and Z. The foreign minister was favorably disposed toward the United States, the American envoys were informed, but in order for negotiations to proceed, a douceur, a sweetener, would be necessary. A bribe of some $250,000 for Talleyrand personally. In addition, a loan of $10 million for the Republic of France was required as compensation for President Adams's insults in his speech before Congress the previous May. Pinckney, Marshall, and Gary refused to negotiate on such terms. Monsieur Ottinger, the X of X, Y, and Z, reminded them of the power and violence of France, as Marshall recorded. But the Americans held their ground. "Gentlemen," said Ottinger, "you do not speak to the point. It is money. It is expected that you will offer the money. What is your answer?" to which General Pinckney emphatically replied, "No, no, not a sixpence." The last of the dispatches was not entirely decoded until March 12th, and for several days Adams struggled over what to do, listening to advice and scribbling his thoughts on paper as his mood swung one way then another. He wrote of the continued violences of the French at sea, of their unexampled arrogance in refusing to receive the envoys, and declared such injury, outrage, and insult more than a self-respecting nation should ever have to submit to. But he also noted that peace might still be attainable, and in fact, peace with honor was still his determined objective. Wild rumors swept the city. It was said France had already declared war on the United States, that the French were moving to take possession of Florida and Louisiana. Adams's message to Congress on March 19th revealed only that the diplomatic mission had failed, and thus he must call again for the measures necessary to defend the nation in the event of attack. It was as mild a statement as he could have made under the circumstances. There was not a word about war, nor anything said of the contents of the dispatches, except that they had been examined and maturely considered. The Republicans immediately decried the message as a declaration of war. In a letter to Madison, Jefferson called it insane and commenced lobbying for ways to delay action and allow time for Bonaparte to invade Britain. Jefferson proposed that members of Congress adjourn at once and go home to consult their constituents on the great crisis. The present period of 2 or 3 weeks, he told Madison in a burst of hyperbole, is the most eventful ever known since that of 1775, and will decide whether the principles established by that contest are to prevail or give way to those they subverted. Convinced that Adams was deliberately withholding information favorable to the French, Republicans in and out of Congress began insisting that the documents be made available at once. Any delay would be a sign of further duplicity. The Aurora taunted Adams for being afraid to tell. "Beds of roses have never been his destiny," Abigail wrote of her husband. Whether he would reveal more of the dispatches was something only he could determine, she told Mary. But clamor who will, great care must be taken that nothing endanger the lives of the envoys who were still in Paris. The Republicans, French agents, and the lying wretch Bache intended to abuse and misrepresent the president until they forced him to resign, and then they will reign triumphant, headed by the man of the people, Jefferson. The respect she had expressed for Jefferson the year before had vanished. How different was the president's situation from that of Washington, whose vice president had never combined with the party against him, never intrigued with foreign ministers or foreign courts against his own government, never made Bache his companion and counselor. John Adams was no warmonger. In self-defense, the country might become involved in a war, and for that, the country should be prepared, which was the president's intent. Of what possible benefit could a war be to him, she asked. He has no ambition for military glory. He cannot add by war to his peace, comfort, or happiness. It must accumulate upon him an additional load of care, toil, trouble, malice, hatred, and I dare say revenge. On Monday, April 2nd, on the floor of the House, Representative Albert Gallatin of Pennsylvania, who had replaced Madison in the leadership of the Republicans, stood to propose that the president be requested to turn over the text of the dispatches. Republicans who had been clamoring for disclosure were now joined by a number of high Federalists who had gotten wind of the damaging content of the dispatches and were happy to help the Republicans step into a trap of their own making. By a vote of 65-27, the House demanded that the full text be delivered at once. Adams, who had apparently concluded that the envoys were by now safely out of France, released the documents the next day. And with the galleries cleared of visitors and the doors secured, the House went into executive session. The revelation that the crisis was not less than the administration implied, but far worse, hit the Republicans like a hammer. "They were struck dumb and opened not their mouths," wrote Abigail. Many representatives privately voiced outrage over the effrontery of Talleyrand and his agents. Some offered lame new arguments. It was said that the whole XYZ story was a contrivance of the Federalist warmongers, that the breakdown of negotiations was the fault of the American envoys. Jefferson, while refusing to comment publicly, privately blamed Adams for past insults to the French, and insisted that Talleyrand and his agents were not, after all, the French government, which was above suspicion. Once the Senate voted to have copies of the documents printed for use within Congress only, it was only a matter of days before they were public knowledge. In the House, Gallatin had urged that the dispatches not be published, certain that they would dash any surviving hope of a settlement with France, which, it appears, was exactly the fear that troubled the president. And indeed, high Federalists were claiming it was too late for preaching peace any longer. The Federalist press protested the damnable outrages of the French, and a wave of patriotic anti-French anger swept the city and the country with unexpected passion. As Abigail reported to Mary Cranch and John Quincy, public opinion in the capital changed overnight. The tricolor cockade of France that Republicans had been wearing in their hats all but disappeared from sight. No one was heard singing French patriotic songs in public as before, or espousing the cause of France. The Aurora, in turn, lashed out at the president as a man unhinged by the delirium of vanity. Had Adams refrained from insulting the French, had he chosen more suitable envoys, the country would never have been brought to such a pass. But in a matter of days, subscriptions and advertising fell off so drastically that it appeared the paper might fail. Anger at Bache and Callender was as intense nearly as at the French. John Fenneau, editor of the rival Gazette of the United States, asked, "In the name of justice and honor, how long are we to tolerate this scum of party filth and beggarly corruption to go thus with impunity?" In the heat of the moment, it was a question many were asking, including the wife of the president. "Bache and his kind had the malice and falsehood of Satan," wrote Abigail, whose dislike of the press, dating from the attacks on Adams by London newspapers a decade before, had nearly reached the breaking point. For the first time, she began to fear for her husband. "Such lies and falsehoods were continually circulated," she wrote to Mary, "and base and incendiary letters sent to the House addressed to him, that I really have been alarmed for his personal safety. With this temper in a city like this, materials for a mob might be brought together in 10 minutes. The country began to prepare for war. On April 8, 1798, Representative Samuel Sewall, a Federalist from Marblehead, Massachusetts, called on Congress to give the president all he had asked for. And slowly, somewhat reluctantly, Congress swung into action. Measures were passed for arming merchant ships. Substantial funds, nearly $1 million, were voted for harbor fortifications and cannon foundries. In May, a bill passed empowering United States warships to capture any French privateer or cruiser found in American waters. "The merchant vessels along the wharf in this city begin to wear a warlike appearance," reported Porcupine's Gazette. "I dare say the French spies have been writing many, many a melancholy letter on the subject to their partisans who are laying off the coast." Led by Gallatin, the Republicans mounted vigorous resistance, and nothing passed by large majorities. The executive party, Gallatin argued, was creating the crisis only to increase their power and to bind us by the treble chain of fiscal, legal, and military despotism. A bill for a provisional army was passed, but not before it was cut from 25,000 men to 10,000, which was still more than Adams had asked for or wanted. For though he was the greatest advocate of the Navy of any American statesman of his generation, Adams deplored the idea of a standing army. The rebirth of the Navy, the wooden walls he wanted above all for defense of the country, and a new department of the Navy separate from the War Department, were his pride and joy. Little that he achieved as president would give him greater satisfaction. And with his choice of the first Secretary of the Navy, the able, energetic Benjamin Stoddart of Maryland, he brought into his administration the one truly loyal ally he had close at hand. From every part of the country came hundreds of patriotic addresses to the president, expressions of loyalty and readiness from state legislatures, merchant groups, fraternal orders, college students, small towns and cities. Suddenly, Adams was awash in a great upswelling of patriotism. His popularity soared. Never had he known such attention and acclaim, which some thought surpassed even what Washington had known while in office. Abigail, making her social calls about the city, found people stopping on the street to bow to her or lift their hats, something she had not experienced before. People begin to see who have been their firm, unshaken friends, steady to their interests and defenders of their rights and liberties, she wrote. In short, we are now wonderfully popular, except with Bache and company, who in his paper calls the president old, querulous, bald, blind, crippled, toothless Adams. At the new theater on Chestnut Street, a young performer named Gilbert Fox was stopping the show each night singing Hail Columbia, which was the President's March with new lyrics composed by Joseph Hopkinson of Philadelphia, son of a signer of the Declaration of Independence, Francis Hopkinson. Abigail was part of the full house the night of its premiere, April 25th, when Fox was called back to sing it three more times, and cheers from the audience, according to Abigail, might have been heard a mile away. The theater, you know, she reminded Thomas, has been called the pulse of the people. A few nights later, with the president in the audience as Fox sang Hail Columbia, the response was still more stupendous. The song was called for over and over. The audience joined in the singing, danced in the aisles. Firm, united, let us be, rallying round our liberty. As a band of brothers joined, peace and safety we shall find. When a lone man tried to sing Sirrah, the marching song of the French Revolution, there were shouts to throw him out. Even the high Federalists heartily approved of John Adams as they never had. The president, it was said, had awakened the nation from its fatal stupor. Adams himself, exhilarated by such unprecedented popularity, appeared to be as caught up in the spirit of the moment as anyone. Deeply touched by the patriotic addresses that kept pouring in, he spent hours laboring to answer them, as if obliged to respond to each and every one. And in some of what he wrote, he appeared ready to declare war any time. "To arms, then, my young friends," he said in reply to the youth of Boston. "To arms, especially by sea." One May afternoon, crowds lined Market Street as 1,000 young men of Philadelphia marched two by two to the president's house, wearing in their hats, as a sign of their support, black cockades like those worn by Washington's troops in the Revolution. Adams received a delegation of them in the levee room, wearing a dress uniform and sword. Yet here and there, in his replies to the patriotic addresses, were to be found clear signs that peace, not war, remained his objective. "I should be happy in the friendship of France upon honorable conditions, under any government she may choose to assume," he said in a letter to the citizens of Hartford, Connecticut. When he called for a day of fasting and prayer, he was roundly mocked in the Republican press. But on the day itself, the churches were filled. To Vice President Jefferson, it was as though an evil spell had been cast over the Capitol. He called it a reign of witches and saw no difference between Adams and the war party. The new Navy, in Jefferson's view, was a colossal waste of money. When a fight broke out between two street gangs wearing the black and tricolor cockades, the cavalry was called in. It had become dangerous to set foot outside the door at night, Jefferson wrote. Politics and party hatreds destroy the happiness of every being here, he told his daughter Martha. They seem like salamanders to consider fire as their element. One French émigré would remember people acting as though a French army might land at any moment. Everybody was suspicious of everybody else. Everywhere one saw murderous glances. Benjamin Bache's house was assaulted, his windows smashed. It was rumored that French agents were plotting to burn the city. At the presidential mansion, Adams finally consented to have a sentry posted at the door. What Adams's thoughts were through all this, he did not record. His personal correspondence had dried up. He wrote almost no letters at all of the kind in which he customarily unburdened himself, in large part because Abigail was with him, but also because he had almost no time to himself. By all signs, however, he was still of two minds in addressing the crisis. In the image of the American Eagle, he still clutched both olive branch and arrows. Even if, on occasion, in his public poses, his head, unlike the eagle's, was turned to the arrows. In his physical appearance, Adams was noticeably changed. He was uncharacteristically pale and had lost weight. He falls away, Abigail noted. If not exactly toothless, as Bache said, he had suffered the loss of several more teeth, about which he was quite self-conscious. Abigail worried that he was smoking too many cigars and working to the point of collapse. Some afternoons he has called from his room 20 times in the course of it to different persons, besides the hours devoted to the ministers of the different departments, the investigation necessary to be made of those persons who apply for offices or are recommended, the weighing the merits and pretensions of different candidates for the same office, etc., etc., etc. I dare not say how really unwell he looks, she told Cotton Tufts. To Mary Cranch, she confided, I think sometimes that if the Congress does not rise and give the President respite, they will have Jefferson sooner than they wish. Yet his spirits were fine, his resolve unwavering in the face of Talleyrand and the Directory. Poor wretches, she wrote, I suppose they want him to cringe. But he is made of oak instead of willow. He may be torn up by the roots, or break, but he will never bend. On June 12th, Adams received news that rocked him more than he dared show. A letter arrived from William Vans Murray, who had replaced John Quincy as minister at The Hague. Dated April 12th, 2 months past, it revealed that while envoys Pinckney and Marshall had left Paris, Elbridge Gerry had remained behind. It seemed France wished to treat with Gerry alone. For Adams, who had banked so much on Gerry against the advice of nearly everyone, it was a painful, infuriating turn of events, as once again Abigail reported to Mary. Can it be possible, can it be believed that Talleyrand has thus declared and fascinated Mr. Gerry, that he should dare to take upon him such a responsibility? I cannot credit it. Yet I know the sin which most easily besets him is obstinacy, and a mistaken policy. You may easily suppose how distressed the President is at this conduct, and the more so because he thought Gerry would certainly not go wrong, and he acted on his own judgment against his counselors, who have been truer prophets than they wish themselves. Gary means the good of his country. He means the peace of it. But he should consider it must not be purchased by national disgrace and dishonor. If he stays behind, he is a ruined man in the estimation of his countrymen. This is all between ourselves. How could Gary possibly stay among the wolves? Mary would ask in response. She felt great distress for the president, she said, but then he ought not have infallibility demanded of him. On June 17th, John Marshall arrived by ship in New York, and in another 2 days received a hero's welcome in Philadelphia. Marshall said nothing about going to war with France, however. Indeed, for all he had been through, Marshall was confident, he told Adams, that the French did not want a war with the United States. Marshall was an impressive man, tall, solidly handsome, unmistakably intelligent, and without airs. Further, unlike all the others advising Adams, he had met with the French and strongly advocated caution and moderation. In effect, Marshall told Adams that there need not be a war, which had been Adams's instinctive sense all along. Marshall also informed him that Elbridge Gerry had remained behind in Paris because he had been told by Talleyrand that if he left, war would follow. Gerry had made his decision for the good of the country, aware of the scorn he would be subjected to at home. If Adams had had any thought of asking for a declaration of war before Congress adjourned, he changed his mind. Instead, he sent a message of all of 4 sentences, the 4th and most important of which was, "I will never send another minister to France without assurances that he will be received, respected, and honored as the representative of a great, free, powerful, and independent nation." But with the war clamor at a pitch, all talk of an alternative solution was limited to private discussion. More common was the opinion that a formal declaration of war could not come too soon, a view most strongly held by those nearest Adams, including his wife. In a letter to John Quincy, Abigail described how the town of Newburyport had taken upon itself to build a 20-gun warship to loan to the government, and that all down the coast other cities were following the example. A few weeks later, she would write to him again of further progress with the subscription ships, her enthusiasm for the burgeoning navy clearly as great as that of her husband. Philadelphia had raised $80,000 to build a 36-gun frigate. New York had subscribed a nearly equal sum for a comparable ship. Baltimore had done the same. "Boston outstrips them all," she wrote. Just months earlier, Abigail had questioned the very idea of war. Now one senses, had she been called upon to serve, she would have signed up and marched off without hesitation. This city, which was formerly torpid with indolence and fettered with Quakerism, she proudly reported, has become one military school, and every morning the sound of the drum and fife lead forth, a band of brothers joined. Writing to Mary Cranch, Abigail berated Congress for being so slow to vote a declaration of war. "Why, when we have the thing, should we boggle at the name?" Contrary to the expectations of nearly everyone, Adams did not ask for a declaration of war against France. Had he done so, the Congress would assuredly have obliged. Instead, they turned their attention to the enemies at home. Another Philadelphia summer had arrived. The temperature in the last week of June was in the 90s. "The weather so hot and close, the flies so tormenting," Abigail wrote. She hardly had energy to move. "Not a leaf stirs till 9 or 10 o'clock. It grows sickly, the city noisome." In 2 sweltering weeks, their popularity and confidence never higher, the Federalist majority in Congress passed into law extreme measures that Adams had not asked for or encouraged. But then neither did he oppose them, and their passage and his signature on them were to be rightly judged by history as the most reprehensible acts of his presidency. Still, the infamous Alien and Sedition Acts of 1798 must be seen in the context of the time, and the context was tumult and fear. Adams later spoke of the Alien and Sedition Acts as war measures. It was how he saw them then and how he chose to remember them. "I knew there was need enough of both, and therefore I consented to them," he would write in explanation long afterward, and at the time the majority of Congress and most of the country were in agreement. There was rampant fear of the enemy within. French émigrés in America, according to the French consul in Philadelphia, by now numbered 25,000 or more. Many were aristocrats who had fled the Terror, but the majority were refugees from the slave uprisings on the Caribbean island of San Domingo. In Philadelphia, a number of French newspapers had been established. There were French booksellers, French schools, French boarding houses, and French restaurants. The French, it seemed, were everywhere. And who was to measure the threat they posed in the event of war with France? In addition to the French, there were the wild Irish, refugees from the Irish Rebellion of 1798, who were thought to include dangerous radicals, and in any case, because of their anti-British sentiment, gladly joined ranks with the Republicans. James Callender was sometimes cited as a prime example of this type, apart from the fact that Callender was a Scot. Beyond that, the United States was at war, declared or not, and there were in fact numbers of enemy agents operating in the country. The Alien Acts included a Naturalization Act, which increased the required period of residence to qualify for citizenship from 5 to 14 years, and the Alien Act, which granted the president the legal right to expel any foreigner he considered dangerous. In the view of the vice president, the Alien Act was something worthy of the 9th century. Jefferson and others imagined a tempestuous John Adams expelling foreigners by the shipload. As it was, they need not have worried. Adams never invoked the law, and this despite the urging of Secretary of State Pickering, who did indeed favor massive deportations. Of greater consequence was the Sedition Act, which made any false, scandalous, and malicious writing against the government, Congress, or the president, or any attempt to excite against them the hatred of the good people of the United States or to stir up sedition, crimes punishable by fine and imprisonment. Though it was clearly a violation of the First Amendment to the Constitution guaranteeing freedom of speech, its Federalist proponents in Congress insisted, like Adams, that it was a war measure, and an improvement on the existing common law in that proof of the truth of the libel could be used as a legitimate defense. Still, the real and obvious intent was to stifle the Republican press, and of those arrested and convicted under the law, nearly all were Republican editors. Such stalwart, respected Federalists as Senators Theodore Sedgwick of Massachusetts and James Lloyd of Maryland were strongly in support of the Sedition Act. Noah Webster, editor, author, lexicographer, and staunch Federalist, declared it time to stop newspaper editors from libeling those with whom they disagreed, and to his friend Timothy Pickering wrote to urge that the new law be strictly enforced. Even George Washington privately expressed the view that some publications were long overdue punishment for their lies and unprovoked attacks on the leaders of the Union. Vice President Jefferson, having no wish to be present for the inevitable passage of the Sedition Act or anything more that might take place in such an atmosphere, quietly packed and went home to Monticello. There were some Federalists who had mixed feelings about the Sedition Act, and John Marshall was openly opposed. Were he in Congress, Marshall said, he would have voted against it. Though Adams appears to have said nothing on the subject at the time, it is hard to imagine him not taking a measure of satisfaction from the prospect of the tables turned on those who had tormented him for so long. And if Adams was reluctant to express his views, Abigail was not. Bache and his kind would inevitably provoke measures to silence them, she had predicted to Mary Cranch. They were so criminal that they ought to be brought to court. Yet daringly do the vile incendiaries keep up in Bache's paper the most wicked and base, violent, and culminating abuse, she wrote another day, sure that nothing will have effect until Congress passes a sedition bill. It was not uncommon in Philadelphia, or in Massachusetts, to hear talk of the unrivaled influence Abigail Adams had on her husband and of her political sense overall. Fisher Ames once observed that she was as complete a politician as any lady in the old French court. That Adams valued and trusted her judgment ahead of that of any of his department heads, there is no question. And she could well have been decisive in persuading Adams to support the Sedition Act. Bearing neither malice or ill will towards anyone, not even the most deluded, I wish the laws of our country were competent to punish the stirrer up of sedition, the writer and printer of base and unfounded calumny, she wrote, and the key word to her was unfounded. She wanted proven lies to be judged unacceptable. This, she was sure, would contribute as much to the peace and harmony of our country as any measure, and in times like the present, a more careful and attentive watch ought to be kept over foreigners. But it was also possible that Adams needed no persuading, and that in what she wrote to Mary Cranch, Abigail was speaking for both of them. Nor, importantly, was her influence always decisive, as shown by his choice of Elbridge Gerry as an envoy to France, and, most importantly, his continued reluctance to declare war. On July 2nd, to meet the cost of the military buildup, the House voted a first direct tax on the people, a tax on land. Also, on July 2nd, to the surprise of many, Adams nominated George Washington as commander-in-chief of the new Provisional Army. It was one of those strokes which the prospect and exigency of the times required, wrote Abigail, and which the president determined upon without consultation. In addition, Adams submitted a list of proposed general officers that included Alexander Hamilton, but also several Republicans, most notably Aaron Burr, as well as his own son-in-law, Colonel Smith. In a matter of days, Congress abrogated the French-American treaties of 1778, created a permanent Marine Corps, passed the Sedition Act, and approved the nomination of Washington as Supreme Commander. War fever was at a pitch. On July 9th, Secretary McHenry left for Mount Vernon by the express mail stage, carrying Washington's commission and a letter from Adams saying that were it in his power to appoint Washington president, he would gladly do so. On July 16th, Congress adjourned and departed the city with a rush. By July 25th, when the Adamses set off, people were already dying in what would become the worst yellow fever epidemic since 1793. Section 4. The year 1798, the most difficult and consequential year of John Adams's presidency, was to provide him no respite. His stay at Quincy would be longer even than the year before. But the stress of the undeclared war, the quasi-war as it came to be known, or half-war as he called it, combined with the threatening ambitions of Alexander Hamilton and growing dissension within Adams's own cabinet, filled his days with frustration and worry. there was precious little peace to be found at Peacefield in the summer of 1798, and especially as Abigail fell so ill that she very nearly died. The first days at home were supposed to have been an even greater delight than usual, for, unbeknown to Adams, a huge improvement to the house had taken place in their absence. An entire wing with a spacious parlor and a library above had been added to the east end, and the whole house new painted, inside and out. Abigail had secretly arranged it all that spring through Cotton Tufts, as a surprise for Adams. It was a wren's house no more. She had doubled its size, much as Jefferson had done at Monticello, except on a considerably smaller scale, and with the difference that she did it entirely to her own wishes, paying for it out of money she saved from household expenses at Philadelphia, and never asking for Adams's permission or opinion. "I meant to have it all done snug before I come," she had told Mary Cranch in April. "I know the president will be glad when it is done, but he can never bear to trouble himself about anything of the kind, and he has not the taste for it." The parlor was for Abigail, the second-floor library or book room for Adams, and like the parlor, it was to have a handsome fireplace and windows on three sides. It must accommodate all his books in regular order and be a pleasant room for the president to do business in, Abigail had directed. But in late June, just as the project was nearly finished, a Quincy neighbor on his way through Philadelphia stopped to pay his respects.